We don't chase trends. We are the wave. Lego to the world. We build. We brave. We build. We brave. We build. We brave. We brave. We build.
Continent DNA.
Nigeria is the most populous black nation on earth. 220 million people. And most of the country runs on private generators, not backup generators, not emergency systems, but primary power supply. The generator that runs all day and all night in homes, in hospitals, in small restaurants, trying to keep the lights on past 9 o'clock. And what you have to sit with, really sit with, is this. Nigeria is sitting on some of the largest hydrocarbon reserves on the planet, a massive, fast-growing consumer market, an extraordinary pool of human talent, genuine demand, genuine capability, genuine resources, and still chronic darkness. That contradiction is where we start, because this is not a story about geography. It is not about missing technology. It is not even really about corruption, though we will get to that. The energy crisis Nigeria lives with today is, to an uncomfortable degree, architecturally self-inflicted. Not because engineers were missing, not because capital never showed up, and not because the market wasn't there, but because the incentives, the actual structural incentives, have been fundamentally misaligned from almost the very beginning. And here is the thesis that runs underneath everything we are about to cover for the next 2 hours. Systems don't malfunction randomly. They perform exactly as they are designed to perform. Nigeria's power sector is not failing. It is actually succeeding at doing exactly what its architecture rewards. If you remember one sentence from this entire episode, it is that one. Because every single thing we walk through today, every scandal, every grid collapse, every policy decision, every missed opportunity, traces back to that principle. I am Tobe Duru, founder and managing director of Apoglide Group, and your host. This is Continent DNA, the show about great opportunities in Africa, the DNA of markets, and the playbook to thrive in them. Today, we are going deep, 90 minutes minimum, probably longer, because the story demands it. Nigeria's electricity, oil and gas, one of the most strategically important and most structurally broken energy markets anywhere in the world. And I want to be direct about what this episode is not. It is not a rundown of production numbers. It is not another post-mortem on grid collapses. We are going underneath all of that into the architecture that produced those outcomes, into the incentive structures that made failure not just possible, but practically inevitable. Because that is where the real story lives. Before we go back in time, I want to set up a lens we are going to use repeatedly throughout this episode. I want you to think like a capital allocator, not a politician, not a citizen, but as a disciplined allocator of institutional capital trying to find the highest risk adjusted return on a 20-year infrastructure bet. If you are that allocator, you are scanning the planet for energy markets with unmet demand, favorable demographics, and growing GDP. Nigeria checks every single one of those boxes. 220 million people. Median age under 19. Urbanization accelerating at a very fast rate. GDP growing as well. Demand for electricity functionally unlimited. Now, compare that to what you would see in, say, Vietnam or Indonesia, markets that were in roughly comparable positions 20 to 30 years ago. Both had large populations, both had resources endowment, both had massive infrastructure deficits, but both built institutional frameworks that let capital flow through to delivery. Vietnam went from roughly 8,000 megawatts in 2000 to over 80,000 megawatts by 2023. Indonesia roughly tripled its capacity over two decades. Nigeria today is still below 5,000 megawatts of actual grid output, with a population significantly larger than either of those countries. So, as a capital allocator, the first thing you would ask is not what is the demand. You already know that. The question is, what is wrong with the architecture? Because that is where the risk lives. Keep that lens active. We are going to come back to it. To understand how Nigeria got here, you have to go back more than a century ago. And I mean that literally. You cannot understand what's happening in 2026 without understanding what happened in 1907. Around 1900, something shifted in how the world's great powers thought about power itself. The age of coal and steam was winding down. What was coming? Oil power ships, aircrafts, modern mechanized warfare required a completely different fuel source. And the nations that locked up supply of that fuel would not just compete, they would shape the 20th century. Britain understood this immediately, and the British government started scanning its colonial territories with one question. Where is the oil? Nigeria got pulled onto that chessboard. The first documented attempt to find oil in Nigeria goes back to 1908. A British businessman and engineer named John Simon Bergheim, who had already convinced the colonial administration that the region had petroleum, secured a license through his company, the Nigeria Bitumen Corporation. But he did not just get a license, he got a monopoly. And this is worth pausing on because it says the pattern for everything that follows. I want you inside this room for a moment as the decision was made then. Picture the colonial office in London, early 1907. The officials writing the oil ordinance are not idiots. They are not naive. They have a very specific problem to solve. Britain needs to secure petroleum supply for its navy. That is the strategic imperative. They are looking at a colonial territory with unknown reserves, limited infrastructure, and no existing regulatory framework for mineral extraction. They have two options. Option one, open the territory to competitive bidding. Let multiple operators enter, build up the market. But that is a slower process and harder to control. And it creates competing interests that London would have to arbitrate remotely. Option two, grant a single license to a single operator, one gatekeeper, one signature, full control from the center. For an empire, managing dozens of territories with limited administrative capacity. Option two is overwhelmingly rational. Monopoly is not chosen because it is efficient. It is chosen because it is controllable. And Berghain, credit where it is due, understood exactly how to position himself inside that logic. He framed his private commercial venture as a strategic imperial asset. He told the Colonial Office that one well-funded British operator was the safest way to secure domestic oil supply for the Royal Navy. He tied commercial ambition directly to national security language. And in doing so, he got the ordinance structured to block foreign competitors. That wasn't luck. That was positioning, and it worked for Berghain. By 1912, Berghain had already drilled roughly 15 wells in the Lekki Lagoon region and spent approximately £143,000. Now, to feel the weight of that money in terms of what that capital actually represented within the 1912 economy, you are looking at something closer to 150 million today in relative purchasing power. This was not casual exploration money. This was serious concentrated capital. And then, September 1912, Berghain died suddenly in a car accident. The entire project collapsed with him. And here is the fundamental structure dagger embedded in Nigeria energy history. Progress almost never gets blocked by geology. It gets blocked by institutions, control structures, and by who is and isn't permitted to operate. His company withdrew. Exploration stopped by mid-1913. World War erupted and Nigeria oil journey paused for 25 years. 25 years. Not because there was no oil, but because there was no institutional structure that could survive the loss of a single man. And here is your first recalibration. Most people think of Nigeria's oil story as beginning in the 1950s with Shell at Olu Ibiri. It did not. It began half a century earlier, and the 25-year gap between Berghain's death and Shell arrival wasn't a geological problem. It was an institutional one. The monopoly model could not survive a single point of failure, and that fragility, that structural dependence on centralized control, is the original code written into Nigeria energy architecture. Everything that follows inherits it. The next chapter opens in 1937. A new player entered Nigeria, an Anglo-Dutch consortium we know today as Shell. And if you are paying attention to the pattern, history rhymed almost perfectly. Shell, just like Berghain, secured exclusive rights to explore virtually the entire country. Whenever opportunity appeared in Nigeria's oil story, monopoly structures followed almost automatically. That is not a coincidence. It is a reflex baked into the architecture from the very start. Shell drilled near Owerri, which is the capital of Imo State today. 7 boreholes, but found nothing. They drilled again after World War II, 1951, and 1953. Still, no success. Then they drilled 13 more wells between 1953 and 1955. Still, no success. And then in 1956, they breakthrough. Shell struck oil in Oluibri, in what is now Bayelsa State, Nigeria's first commercial discovery. 2 years later, a 72-kilometer pipeline ran from Oluibri to Port Harcourt. On February 17, 1958, Nigeria exported its first shipment of crude oil, 5,000 barrels per day. Modest in volume, enormous in consequence. And here is what I want you to track from this moment forward. Once crude starts to move, institutions reorganize around it, laws adjust, revenue systems get redesigned, patronage networks grow. The oil does not just flow through pipelines, it seeps into the design of political power itself. From 1958 through the mid-1970s, Shell BP was the undisputed architect of oil in Nigeria. They did not just find and drill oil, they built the entire operational system, the pipelines, the business rules, the royalty structures, the administrative architecture, just everything. But success attracts competition. Late 1950s, early 1960s, Mobil, Tenneco, Texaco, Gulf, now called Chevron, Elf, Ajib, Esso, entered Nigeria. When Nigeria gained independence in 1960, that influx accelerated. Within 5 years, 9 major international oil companies were operating in the country. The stage looked set for a booming industry. What nobody could see was that this fountain of wealth was about to become the financial engine for one of the most devastating civil wars in modern African history. To understand Nigeria's energy crisis at its root, I mean really at the root, at the level where the code was written, you have to draw a straight line from the Biafra War all the way to how the sector is architected today. 60 years apart, same structural logic. Oil did not cause the war, to be precise, but it absolutely shaped how the war was fought, and far more importantly, how Nigeria rewrote its laws the moment the war ended. Nigeria gained independence in 1960. The regional system it inherited, a colonial framework where 3 major regions held real autonomy and specific revenue rights, was fragile from the war. Different ethnic groups, different economic bases, different political ambitions, all held together by a federal structure that nobody had stress tested. Then, 1966, a military coup took place. General Agi Irunsi takes power, first military head of state in Nigeria, distinguished officer from the eastern part of the country. That detail alone, his origin, triggered political shockwaves. Month later, a counter-coup led by northern officers removes him. Lieutenant Colonel Yakubu Gowon takes charge. And in the middle of this turbulence, the eastern region, which sat directly on top of the Niger Delta oil reserves, began to fear economic marginalization, and reasonably so. By 1966, Shell and Elf were already producing around 400,000 barrels per day in the southeast. Eastern leadership made a clear high-stakes demand. Oil royalties should flow directly to the producing region, not to the federal government. Their logic was straightforward from where they stood. The oil was physically inside the eastern region. The region should be the primary beneficiary to fund industrialization, to expand education, to uplift its people, to control its economic destiny. Lagos, which was then the capital of Nigeria, refused immediately. Now, here is where it gets really interesting from an incentive perspective. I want you inside Shell BP decision room for a moment. You are a senior executive. You are producing oil in the East. The Eastern government is demanding you pay them directly. The federal government of Nigeria is demanding you pay. You are caught between two sovereign claims on the same revenue stream. What do you fear? You fear being locked out of the country entirely. You fear nationalization. You fear your physical assets are being seized by whichever side loses. And you need a decision fast, very fast, because the political situation is deteriorating by the week. Shell BP offered to pay the Eastern region directly. The federal government responded with a blockade of the oil terminal. And right there, oil stopped being a commodity. It became political power. Control of that oil meant control of the Nigerian state itself. May 1967, 7 years after independence, the Eastern region declared itself the Republic of Biafra. A civil war erupted. Between 1 and 3 million people died over 3 years. The exact figures are still debated, but no serious historian disputes the scale. To feel the weight of what that conflict caused in human terms, at the low estimate of 1 million deaths, that is roughly the entire population of a city the size of Cologne in Germany or San Jose, California, gone just in 3 years. And at the high estimate, you are approaching the total military death in the American Civil War, except Biafra's toll was overwhelmingly civilian. And in the middle of that war, while the fighting was still going on, a quiet legal maneuver took place. November 27, 1969, months before the war officially ended, Nigeria passed the Petroleum Act of 1969. Think carefully about that timing. A war still burning, military logic shaping every decision, and in the background, a single sentence being written into law. All petroleum in, under, or upon any land in Nigeria belongs exclusively to the federal government. That sentence changed everything. No region, no community, and no state could ever again claim ownership over petroleum resources in Nigeria. Oil was centralized permanently, written into law while the country was still at war. I want to slow down here because this is the structural inflection point that governs everything that comes after. And I want you to understand the decision from the inside. You are in the federal military government. It is late 1969. You are winning the war. But the war started because a region tried to secede. And that secession was funded or would have been funded by oil revenue. You have one overriding fear that this happens again, that any region with oil under its soil accumulates enough economic power to challenge the center. So you write a law, not just any law for that matter, but a law that eliminates the economic basis for future succession. You don't just win the military campaign. You restructure the ownership architecture of the nation's most valuable asset. You make future bargaining structurally impossible. This was not a neutral policy adjustment. It was a wartime instrument, a deliberate line written into law specifically to eliminate the threat that the center had just fought a three-year war on to contain. And once ownership is federalized, the battlefield does not disappear. It just changes form. It moves into contracts, approval, licenses, cash flows, who signs, who gets paid, who controls assets. And from that moment forward, that is from 1969 onward, every negotiation in Nigeria's energy sector would flow through one address, the center. Here is your second recalibration. Most people look at the Petroleum Act of 1969 as a sovereignty accession, which it was, but look at what it actually did to the incentive structure. It did not just centralize revenue, it centralized the entire architecture of rent seeking. Every actor who wanted access to oil revenue, politicians, contractors, intermediaries, now had exactly one target, one set of relationships to cultivate, one approval chain to navigate. The act did not just centralize oil, it centralized corruption's address. The Biafra War ended in January 1970. The structure it produced did not. Before 1971, the Nigerian government did not actually own the oil wells or the production assets. It was largely a regulator, collecting rents, taxes, royalties. Foreign companies operated with significant autonomy. But in 1971, that changed. Nigeria established the Nigerian National Oil Corporation, the NNOC. The logic was clear. Stop being a passive rent collector. Become an active participant in the value chain. Capture more of what the oil is currently worth. Same year, Nigeria joined OPEC. 2 years later, the federal government acquired a 35% ownership stake in major oil operations, then increased it to 55% later. And then, in 1977, the government decided it needed something bigger. They took the NNOC, which is the commercially operating arm, and merged it with the Ministry of Petroleum, the arm responsible for writing and enforcing the sector's rules. That fusion created the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, the NNPC. Now, I really need you to absorb this. I want you in the room where this merger is being designed. It is 1977. The military government under Obasanjo is thinking about institution building. They have just watched the oil price quadruple in 1973. Revenue is surging, and they are looking at models from around the world. Saudi Arabia has Aramco. Iran has NIOC. Mexico has Pemex. The logic of a national oil champion feels both obvious and urgent. But here is the structural choice that mattered most. Do you separate the regulator from the operator, or do you merge them? Separation creates checks and balances, but it is slower. It requires more institutional capacity, more lawyers, more administrative infrastructure. A merger is faster, cleaner on paper. One entity that can move at the speed of government ambition. And critically, a single entity is easier for a military government to direct. One phone call, one chain of command. So they merged, and in doing so, they create something structurally unprecedented even by the standards of state oil companies. the NNPC wasn't just a company drilling oil. It was also the regulator designing the rules, commercial operator, joint venture partner, infrastructure owner, contract negotiator, rule maker, referee, and player on the same field. The NNPC became an integrated oil company with extraordinary influence, operating inside a state monopoly of enormous scale. Player, referee, and league commissioner, all housed in one building. And I want you to trace the lineage, because this is where compounding structural logic becomes feasible. Colonial monopoly, one gatekeeper controlling access, wartime centralization, one government owning the resource, post-war nationalization, one institution running the entire industry. Three distinct phases, same instinct, same architecture, and concentration philosophy. Each layer did not replace the previous one. It inherited the previous one and added new weight. The colonial instinct for centralized control was inherited by the wartime legal framework. The wartime framework was inherited by the peacetime institutional design. Each generation of leaders faced a fresh set of problems, but reached for the same structural tool, consolidate authority at the center. A monopoly culture produces a monopoly architecture, and monopoly architecture almost inevitably produces incentives that reward control over delivery. This structure, shaped by colonial precedents, wartime logic, and post-war ambition, continues to define Nigeria's energy sector today in ways most people don't fully appreciate. It also created a system deeply vulnerable to waste, inefficiency, and something far more deliberate, which brings us to the question that no power minister, no petroleum minister has convincingly answered in decades. Where did the money go? The answer to that question begins in 1999, when Nigeria returned to domestic rule after 33 years of military governance. Quick context. During most of that military era, there was virtually no meaningful capital investment in energy infrastructure. By the time democracy returned, Nigeria had 79 power generation units on paper. Of those 79, only 19 were actually functional. 79 units built, 19 working. That is a 76% failure rate on the existing fleet before the democratic era even begins. So, between 1999 and 2007, 8 years of democratic government, approximately $16 billion was budgeted and reportedly spent on Nigeria electricity sector. Not Naira, dollars, $16 billion. Capital was supposed to build major power plant, rehabilitate transmission infrastructure, upgrade distribution networks, transform the grid. But none of this happened. At the end of that period, after $16 billion, Nigeria's actual electricity output had barely moved, still stuck at around 4,000 megawatts. Let me give you a way to feel that number. $16 billion is roughly what it costs to build the Three Gorges Dam, the largest power station on Earth by installed capacity. One country spent that and got 22,500 megawatts. Nigeria spent the same and got nothing measurable. Or think of it this way. South Africa's entire Medupi power station, one of the largest dry cooled coal plants ever built, came in at roughly $15 billion after massive court overruns and years of delays that were considered a national scandal. And Medupi still delivered 4,764 megawatts. Nigeria spent comparable capital and the needle did not move. In any functional system, spending translates into capacity, into reliability, into measurable uptime. Here, the spending translated into paperwork, into contractor invoices for projects that were never completed. And I want to be very precise about this, structurally engineered for leakage rather than delivery. The story of Nigeria's grid collapse is not primarily a story of technical incompetence. It is a story of systemic financial drain at the highest levels of the state, sustained across several decades, and the architecture we just walked through, decentralized, monopoly-based, single gatekeeper model, is precisely what made that drain possible. Now, bring back the capital allocator lens. You are looking at this from the outside. You see $16 billion deployed with no measurable output increase. What does that tell you about the system? It tells you that the system deployed into this architecture does not convert into capacity. It gets absorbed by the architecture itself. The leakage isn't a side effect. It is a feature of how the system processes money. And as an allocator, that is the single most dangerous signal you can receive, because it means the problem isn't underinvestment. It is that the conversion mechanism is broken. Pouring more capital in does not fix a broken conversion mechanism. It feeds it. Compare that to how capital was deployed in, say, Bangladesh power sector, or roughly the same period. Bangladesh went from about 4,000 megawatts in the early 2000s to over 25,000 megawatts by 2023. Not necessarily with more money, but with better conversion. Their institutional architecture wasn't perfect, but capital that went in came out as megawatts. In Nigeria, capital that went in came out as invoices. All of that mismanagement revealed two things simultaneously. First, colossal amount of money could disappear without consequence. Second, the system itself was structured to reward those who extracted rather than those who built. And this is where the story shifts from institutional weakness to active predation. The NNPC, the state-owned superstructure we just walked through, gradually became the center of one of the most notorious corruption sagas in Nigeria's energy history. And it reached a visible peak during Dizani Alisin Madueke's tenure as Minister of Petroleum Resources. As of the time of recording, she remains on trial in England, facing 5 counts of accepting bribes and 1 count of conspiracy to commit bribery in connection with multi-million pound oil and gas contracts between 2011 and 2015. Her tenure was defined by the largest scale abuse of oil swap and crude oil lifting schemes. And to understand why this matters structurally, not just as a scandal, but as an architectural problem, you need to understand the mechanism. An oil swap is a contractual arrangement where the NNPC exchanges crude oil directly for refined petroleum products. Nigeria's state-owned refineries had gone offline, unreliable from the mid-1990s, essentially not functional by the 2000s. The government could not refine its own crude, so it needed a workaround to keep domestic fuel supply moving. On paper, a practical solution. In practice, a massive discretionary contract structure where billions in oil revenues evaporated. Volumes were inflated. Prices were manipulated. Contracts went to favored intermediaries without competitive process or transparency. The system had learned to monetize its own failure. The refineries broke down, and then the breakdown itself became a profit center for those who controlled the work around. Think about the perverse incentive architecture. You are a politically connected intermediary. You are making enormous margins on oil swap contracts. Your revenues depends entirely on the refineries staying offline. Now, someone proposes fixing the refineries. What is your rational response? You oppose it, not publicly, not obviously, but through delay, through bureaucratic obstruction, through making sure the contracts to rehabilitate refineries go to entities that will never actually deliver. If you fix the refineries, the swap contracts disappear, and with them, the revenue streams flow into political connected intermediaries. That is an incentive map. And incentive maps are the most reliable predictor of institutional behavior. Losses documented by Nigeria's EFCC, the US Department of Justice, and the UK's National Crime Agency run into tens of billions of dollars. If the Dizani saga exposed internal bleeding inside the NNPC, the Malabar OPL245 case exposed something even more disturbing: global complicity. OPL245, one of Africa's most lucrative offshore oil blocks, estimated to hold up to 9 billion barrels of reserves. Let me put 9 billion barrels in context. At peak valuation, roughly 500 billion worth of oil sitting under the seabed. That is roughly the entire GDP of Norway in a single year, sitting in one offshore block. This is a prime real estate in the energy world. In 1998, the block was controversially awarded to Malabar Oil and Gas, a company linked to Dan Etete, who served as Minister of Petroleum Resources from 1995 to 1998. Let that land. The petroleum minister awarded one of Africa's most valuable oil blocks to a company connected to himself. A 1.3 billion payment from Shell and Eni followed. Of that sum, approximately $1.1 billion, money that was supposed to flow to the Nigerian state, was allegedly diverted into private accounts connected to Etete and his associates. Shell and Eni faced prosecution in European courts. They were ultimately acquitted for lack of evidence, proving criminal conspiracy. But the broader change was already structural. The Malabar case illustrates a brutal reality. Nigeria's energy crisis is not only a domestic government failure, it is also a story of international actors operating inside and benefiting from structural dysfunction. The dysfunction isn't a bug for everyone. For some participants, It is business model. And then there is the fuel subsidy. And this might be the most structurally absurd chapter in the entire story. With refineries offline, Nigeria imported virtually all of its refined fuel to keep petroleum prices artificially low, because low fuel prices are politically popular. The government paid subsidies to importers. Over time, this became a massive fiscal sinkhole. For years, Nigeria spent more on fuel subsidies than it allocated to health, education, and infrastructure combined. Let me say that again. A major oil-producing nation spent more subsidizing imported fuel than it spent on hospitals and schools combined. To put a final point on it, Nigeria's fuel subsidy bill in peak years exceeded the entire national budget of several neighboring West African countries. And the subsidy system did not just become inefficient, it became a magnet for industrial scale fraud. Companies billed the government for fuel that was never imported. Audits found that reported import frequently exceeded Nigeria's actual storage capacity. Billions paid for phantom fuel. So Nigeria, a major oil producer, was importing most of its refined fuel and paying subsidies to fraudsters for fuel that never existed. A paradox engineered not by geology or lack of talent, but by incentives that systematically rewarded waste over productivity. Here is your third recalibration. The subsidy regime isn't a separate problem from everything we have been discussing. It is the same architecture in a different costume. The refineries failed because the monopoly structure had no competitive pressure to maintain them. The failure created a workaround. The workaround created rent-seeking opportunities. The rent seekers captured the subsidy system, and the captured subsidy system created an incentive to keep the refineries broken. Each failure produced the conditions for the next failure. That is not a sequence of bad luck. That is compounding structural dysfunction. And every one of these mechanisms, the swap contracts, the OPL 245 deal, the phantom fuel subsidies, traces directly back to the same architectural route: centralized control, monopoly gatekeeping. A single point of authority controlling enormous resource flow without competitive pressure, market discipline, or genuine accountability. The architecture produced the outcome every time. Before we move on, I want to pause and do something we don't do often enough in analysis like this. I want to ask, what if the architecture had been different? Specifically, what if in 1977, instead of merging the NNOC with the Ministry of Petroleum, Nigeria had kept them separate? What if the regulatory function and the commercial function have been housed in independent institutions with separate mandates, separate budgets, and separate accountability chains? This is not a fantasy. Maui did exactly this. Stad Oil was the commercial operator. The Norwegian Petroleum Directorate was the regulator. The Ministry of Petroleum set policy. Three separate institutions, clear line, competing mandate that created structural tension, which is exactly what a healthy system needs. If Nigeria had built a similar separation in 1977, the regulator would have had no commercial incentive to overlook leakage. The commercial operator would have faced regulatory scrutiny from an independent body. Contract awards would have required approval from an entity that did not benefit from the contract themselves. Would corruption have disappeared? Of course, no. But the architecture would have made large-scale extraction dramatically harder. Each node in the system would have had a structural reason to check the others. The discerning error swap abuse would have required collusion across independent institutions, not just control of one integrated entity. Norway's sovereign wealth fund, built on oil revenue, now holds over $1.7 trillion. Nigeria's excess crude account has been consistently depleted, raided, and contested. Same commodity, same global market, radically different architecture, radically different outcomes. The counterfactual does not prove what would have happened, but it illuminates what the actual architecture made almost certain to happen. And that is the point. The outcome wasn't inevitable because of Nigeria's culture or geography. It was inevitable because of institutional design choices that concentrated power without countervailing structure. All right, now we shift, because everything up to this point has been about oil and how its ownership reshaped political power. But here is something that most people, including many Nigerians, don't fully appreciate. Nigeria is not really an oil country, not fundamentally. Nigeria is a gas nation. Nigeria holds the largest proven natural gas reserves in Africa. It ranks among the top 10 gas-rich nations in the world. Over 200 trillion cubic feet of proven reserves, with prospectivity estimates running as high as 600 trillion cubic feet. In many ways, Nigeria isn't an oil country with some gas. It is a gas province with a little bit of oil. And that fact, buried inside the geology, is at the heart of everything. So here is what I think of the gas paradox, and it might be the single most important structural contradiction in this entire story. A gas nation that cannot power itself. The reason is surprisingly simple: the price. The Nigerian government sets the domestic base price for gas supplied to power producers at roughly $2.13, a capped regulated price, not a free market price. Now, I want you in the decision room of a gas producer. You are sitting on a massive reserve. You have two buyers. Buyer one is the domestic power market. They will pay $2.13 per million BTU. Payment is unreliable. The off-taker is frequently insolvent. Contractual enforcement is weak. Political risk is also high. Buyer two is the international LNG market. They will pay several multiples of that price in US dollars. With strong contractual discipline, blue chip counterparties, predictable cash flow. What do you fear? You fear being trapped in a domestic market that cannot pay you. You fear stranded capital. You fear regulatory changes that could further compress your margins. So, what do rational producers do? They behave rationally. They prioritize the export market. They demand prepayment or strict terms of domestic supply. They avoid long-term exposure to a domestic market that struggles with payment reliability. And from a capital allocation perspective, this is where the mispricing becomes devastating. The domestic gas price does not reflect the true opportunity cost of the molecule. It is administratively set below market clearing, which means every unit of gas directed to the domestic power market represents a subsidy from the gas producer to the power sector. But it is an involuntary, uncompensated subsidy. So producers route capital and molecules to where returns are fair. The domestic market gets the leftover, and the leftover is what runs your hospitals and your factories. Compare this to how Qatar manages its domestic gas allocation. Qatar prioritizes domestic industrial and power demand through long-term contracts with price mechanisms that are commercially viable for producers. The domestic market competes for molecules on terms that make economic sense. Nigeria's domestic market does not compete. It commands, and commands backed by unforeseeable prices produce shortages. The outcome is almost structurally inevitable. Nigeria built an oil-driven revenue model on top of what is fundamentally a gas nation, and it has paid the price for that misalignment every single day in every home that runs a generator instead of a light switch. Here is your fourth recalibration. When people here in Nigeria has an electricity problem, they think about generators and grid collapses and distribution companies. But the real choke point is upstream. If the domestic gas price does not attract supply, nothing downstream matters. You can build all the power plants you want. If the fuel does not show up, the turbines sit idle. The electricity crisis is a gas pricing crisis wearing a different name. Now, let me walk you through how the electricity system actually works in Nigeria, because this is where the abstract becomes mechanical. There are three layers. Each one is its own battlefield, and critically, each one inherits the dysfunction. Layer 1, generation, the GenCos. Roughly 23 to 40 grid-connected power plants falling into three categories. Privatized GenCos, previously government-owned asset, but now in private hands. Independent power producers, fully private new built plants built by private investors, and the NIPP plants, still government funded, bought, intended for eventual privatization. As of February 2026, these power producers are in a state that insiders describe as technical insolvency. They are owned over 6.2 trillion naira in unpaid invoices for electricity already generated, supplied, and even consumed. I want you to feed that number, 6.2 trillion naira at current exchange rates, that is roughly $4 billion in receivables that power producers are currently carrying on their books. That is more than the entire annual revenue of many mid-sized utilities in developed markets. It is roughly what Eskom, South Africa's state power utility, collects in revenue every 4 to 5 months, except Eskom receives that money. On average, GenCos receive only about 35% of their monthly invoices. If you speak privately with executives inside these companies, off the record, the language gets very direct. Two words immediately come to mind: liquidity trap. The turbines can run, the engineers are available, the technical capacity exists. But when invoices are paid at 35 cents on the dollar, long-term planning slowly becomes short-term survival, and survival eventually becomes the strategy. Layer 2, transmission, the TCN. The transmission company of Nigeria faces aging infrastructure, chronic underinvestment, frequent system collapses. Even if a Genco produces 1,000 megawatts, the grid may only accept 400. The Gencos still incurs the cost of keeping turbines ready, but it is often only compensated for what was actually dispatched and consumed, and not what was generated. Following the Electricity Act of 2023, the government unbundled TCN and created the Nigerian Independent System Operator. The intent is simple: to separate the referee from the infrastructure operator, reduce conflicts of interest, and reduce grid collapses. Layer 3, distribution, the DISCOs. The entities delivering electricity to end users. And this is where the entire financial chain breaks. The 2013 privatization effectively set many of them up to fail. And I want you in the room where that privatization was designed. The government then needed to divest. International lenders and advisors were pushing for private sector participation. The model looked clean on paper, but the buyers instead inherited aging networks while simultaneously carrying large debt burdens and navigating constant political interference. Their central challenge is devastating in its simplicity. They cannot collect enough revenue to fully pay the generation companies, non-payment by customers, energy theft through illegal connections, and meter bypassing are additional problems the discos struggle with. Tariffs are kept artificially low for political reasons, far below what it actually costs to generate and deliver power. In addition to that, customers' willingness to pay is also low, partly because about 45% of electricity bills in Nigeria are based on estimated billing. That further increases the challenges the discos face. When consumers feel they are being charged for power they did not receive, payment discipline collapses, and when discos cannot collect, the entire financial chain breaks from the bottom up. And here is a recalibration on the discos. The conventional narrative says the distribution companies are incompetent or corrupt. Some may be, but let us zoom out for a second. They bought assets with known deficiencies. They operate under tariffs set by politicians who fear voter backlash. They serve customers who have been trained by decades of unreliable service to resist payment, and they are expected to be commercially viable inside a system where the generation layer above them can't get fuel and the transmission layer between them can't deliver full capacity. The discos aren't operating in a market. They are operating inside a trap. And the trap was set before they walked in. NBET, the single point of failure. In the middle of all this dysfunction, one institution became the critical bottleneck in Nigeria's electricity market, the Nigerian Bulk Electricity Trading PLC, known as NBET. think back to the original pitch, the one made to investors and lenders when the system was being designed. Build the plant, feed the grid. A government back off-taker will pay you on time. Bankable, predictable, and safe. That was the story. But then reality hits. I want you in the shoes of an independent power producer. You have invested hundreds of millions of dollars into a gas fire plant. You even took that risk because the government, through NBET, promised to be a credible, bankable off-taker. You went to international lenders with that government guarantee. You modeled 20-year cash flows based on that promise. Then the discos fail to collect. They can't pay NBET in full. NBET can't pay you, the independent power generator. Your receivables grow. Your debt service stays fixed. Your lenders start calling. What do you fear? Default, asset stranding, or reputational damage that prevents you from raising capital for your next project anywhere in Africa? And slowly, almost quietly, the word bankable starts to lose its meaning. What was presented as a stable structure becomes a cycle of dependency where everyone is waiting on someone else and nobody actually controls the cash. NBET was designed as a financial bridge, a temporary stabilizer while the market matured. Instead, it became a permanent bottleneck, a monopoly buyer, a monopoly seller, a single point of systemic vulnerability. Now, pull back to the capital allocation lens one more time. You are an institutional investor evaluating African energy infrastructure. You are comparing Nigeria to Kenya, where independent power producers like Lake Turkana Wind have operated with relatively stable off-take arrangements, or to Morocco, which has attracted billions in renewable energy investment through clear contractual frameworks and credible counterparties. Nigeria has all the demand, but the counterparty chain is broken. Every link depends on the link below it, and the bottom link, that is consumer collection, is structurally weak. So you don't invest, or if you do, you demand sovereign guarantees, concessional terms, and risk premiums. That makes project even more expensive. These, in turn, pushes tariffs higher. That makes collection even harder. Missed price risks does not just deter capital, it compounds fragility. Each failed investment cycle makes the next one harder. Each broken promise raises the cost of the next promise. The system does not just fail to attract capital, it actively repels it. And the repulsion accelerates over time. On July 25th, 2024, Nigeria's Electricity Regulatory Commission issued an order requiring NBET to stop entry into new electricity purchase and resale contracts. The gradual dismantling of NBET as a central wholesaler had begun. Nigeria finally confronted a hard truth. You cannot build a modern competitive electricity market around a single government-controlled wholesaler. That structure may look elegant on paper, but in a real economy with real incentives and real human behavior, it becomes fragile, very fragile power must flow through enforceable bilateral contracts and commercial discipline, not through centralized discretion. Now, let me give you the economic picture, because the numbers here are staggering once you actually walk through them. Nigeria delivers roughly 37 to 40 terawatt hours of grid electricity annually. For a population of more than 220 million people, that is extremely low by any global standard. Countries supporting a $1 trillion industrial economy, the kind Nigeria aspires to reach by 2030, typically consume somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 kilowatt hours per person per year. Nigeria today is a fraction of that. South Korea, for example, consumes roughly 10,000 kilowatt hours per capita. Even Egypt, with a population about half Nigeria's size, generates roughly four times as much grid electricity. Moving into that range would mean a 17 to 18 times increase in generation. Total annual electricity demand would climb toward 600 to 700 terawatt hours. At an average blended price of around 10 cents per kilowatt hour, Nigeria's electricity market is worth between $60 and $70 billion every single year. And a $2 trillion economy with deeper industrialization could push demand towards 1,000 terawatt hours per person. At that scale, you are talking about a potential electricity industry worth well over $100 billion annually. The current system is not just underperforming at a tiny fraction of the scale required to support the economic ambitions constantly discussed in policy cycles. The gap is not small, it is exponential. And that gap, that $60 to $100 billion gap, is the true cause of the architecture we have been tracing so far. Now, we step back and we look at the full picture, because when you zoom out from the history, from the scandals, from the financial crimes, from the broken electricity chain, what you see is not simply a story about blackouts. It is a story about incentives. And incentives are the most reliable predictor of how any system behaves. Now, we have reached the point where we push back and examine Nigeria's energy sector through the lens of market forces. To do that, we apply Porter's five forces to the Nigerian energy industry, because this framework helps us understand the deeper structural drivers behind the dysfunction and, more importantly, where the real solution might lie. A quick recap: Porter's five forces is a strategic framework that explains how competitive pressure from rivals, new entrants, substitutes, supplier power, and buyer power determines the profitability and stability of any industry. And when you look at Nigeria's energy sector through that lens, the conclusions becomes uncomfortable, almost brutal. Let us start with competitive structure. Nigeria should be one of the most attractive energy markets on earth. A population approaching 240 million people, massive unmet demand, genuine willingness to pay for reliable electricity because people are already paying, just not to the grid. On paper, this should be the hottest energy investment destination on the planet. But every new entrant that attempts to enter hits the same wall. gas supply is unreliable. The transmission grid can't consistently evacuate power. The payment intermediary may not pay on time. The regulatory environment shifts with political cycles. Nigeria has customers. Nigeria has demand. Nigeria has capital seeking returns, but it lacks the institutional infrastructure to connect those three things. This isn't a welcoming gateway. It is a structural obstacle course. On the supply side, gas producers hold disproportionate leverage. Power plants cannot operate without them. So producers behave rationally. They prioritize LNG exports and demand prepayment. They also avoid long-term domestic exposure. In fact, they control the choke point. When one group of suppliers can effectively shut down an entire industry by withholding supply, you don't have a balanced market. You have structural dependency. And structural dependency behaves like a hostage dynamic. On the consumer side, buyer power is almost non-existent. Distribution territories are fixed. Tariffs are regulated. Service quality is unpredictable. So consumers do the only rational thing available to them. They leave the grid. And this might be the most striking data point in this entire episode. Over 40 gigawatts of decentralized generation capacity through private generators. Roughly 22 million households running generators regularly. An estimated $10 to $12 billion spent annually on fuel and generator maintenance across the country. To put that in perspective, $12 billion is roughly what the entire country of Ghana spends on total government expenditure in a year. Nigeria's households are effectively spending the equivalent of Ghana's national budget just to keep the lights on independently. In Germany, electricity costs roughly 25 cents per kilowatt hour. In Nigeria, the premium Band A grid price is about 15 cents. On the surface, 15 cents looks like a bargain. But Nigeria did not lose its electricity market to a competing utility. It lost it to a shadow utility that households and businesses built for themselves. Millions of micro utilities powered by frustration. This is not a minor threat on the horizon. It is a structural shift that has already happened. The question is not just what electricity costs, it is what it costs when it is not there. And here is your sixth recalibration. The shadow utility is not just a coping mechanism. It is a competing system, and it has a structural advantage that the grid does not have. It actually works. It is expensive. It is polluting. It is inefficient, but it delivers. Every Nigerian who buys a generator is making a rational capital allocation decision. They are investing in reliability. And every generator sold is a vote of no confidence in the grid's architecture. The longer the grid fails, the more entrenched the shadow utility becomes. And the more entrenched the shadow utility becomes, the harder it is to attract capital back to the grid. Because potential grid customers have already built their own alternatives. That is not just a market failure. That is a feedback loop that locks the system into permanent underperformance. And when you look at the competitive structure, distribution companies with territorial monopolies, generation companies constrained to sell only through NBET until recently, TCN as the sole transmission provider, what you see is not a competitive market. It is a chain of protected monopolies. And when every actor is shielded from competitive pressure, no actor has a strong incentive to improve performance. Each actor can mismanage, delay, or underperform. And instead of the system correcting itself, it simply absorbs the dysfunction and continues. A sector architecturally engineered to fail, regardless of how much money or technical expertise is injected into it, because the architecture itself is the failure mode. Nigeria's energy crisis is not a mystery. It is not a failure of intelligence, not a shortage of capital, not a lack of engineering talent at all. It is the predictable output of incentives layered over more than a century of institutional design, colonial monopoly, wartime centralization, state consolidation, subsidy distortion, export prioritization. Each of those decisions made sense in its own historical moment. Each one had a logic. Each one had a justification. But layered together over decades, compounded, they produced a system that cannot consistently deliver stable power to 220 million people. Not because of a single catastrophic failure, but because of accumulated architectural choices that each individually seemed reasonable. And now I want to bring the threads together, because this is where the compounding becomes fully visible. Decision 1, 1907, the Colonial Office writes the Oil Ordinance as a monopoly instrument. One gatekeeper, one license, one point of control. The instinct is efficiency through centralization. Decision 2, 1969, the Petroleum Act centralizes all hydrocarbon ownership at the federal level. Written during wartime, designed to eliminate the economic basis for future succession. The instinct is security through concentration. Decision 3, 1977, the NNPC merger combines regulatory and commercial function. The instinct is speed through consolidation. No separation of power, no structural checks. Decision 4, the gas pricing regime. Domestic gas capped at a fraction of international market value. The instinct is affordability through price controls, but the consequence is that rational producers route supply elsewhere. Decision 5, NBET as sole intermediary. A government-backed wholesaler designed to make the market bankable. The instinct is confidence through centralization. But when the bottom of the chain can pay, the entire structure collapses upward. Five decisions, spanning over a century, each one rational in its moment, each one concentrating authority at the center, and each one compounding the structural fragility of the one before it. The 1907 monopoly instinct did not die. It just kept finding new institutional forms. Each generation of leaders inherited the architecture of centralized control. The Wartime Act inherited the colonial reflex. The NNPC inherited the Wartime Act. The gas pricing regime inherited the NNPC's monopoly logic. NBET inherited the assumption that one central entity could manage market risks, five layers of the same instinct. And when you stack them, you get a system that is incapable of self-correction. If you want the cleanest way to summarize the entire story, go all the way back to 1907. That was the moment the system first learned the habit of monopoly. One gatekeeper, one license, one center of control. That instinct did not fade. It expanded. It scaled. It evolved from colonial monopoly to wartime centralization, to the NNPC superstructure, to the NBET bottleneck, to protected distribution territories, monopoly chains embedded inside the electricity market itself. A monopoly culture produces a monopoly architecture, and monopoly architecture almost inevitably produces incentives that reward control over delivery, that reward extraction over construction, that reward political assets over operational excellency. So the outcome we see today is not mysterious. It is logical. It is architectural. And here is the harder truth and the more important one. Reliable electricity will not emerge from another bailout, from another emergency committee, from another political speech, or from another imported consultant's report. Those interventions don't work, not because the people behind them are incompetent, but because they are trying to fix outcomes while leaving the architecture that produces those outcomes intact. And this is the final recalibration. Reform that don't touch the incentive architecture is not reform. It is maintenance. Every bailout that leaves the monopoly chain intact is a capital injection into a system designed to absorb capital without converting it into delivery. Every tariff adjustment that does not address the gas pricing distortion is a surface level intervention on top of a structural problem. The architecture is the problem. And until the architecture changes, the outcomes are locked in. Reliable power will come from redesigning the incentive structure itself, from making the right behavior the profitable behavior, from building a system where the actor who generates the most reliable power, not the one with the most political connections, captures the most value. Power does not fail by accident, it fails by architecture. And architecture, no matter how old, no matter how entrenched, can be redesigned. That is the work to be done. Keep building. I am Dobe Duru. See you in the next episode. Thank you for listening. Continent DNA.